They call it the ALVSP structure. So this is for how to sort of help, this is teenagers, to manage and regulate themselves. But we can definitely do this for children as well. So A, step one is acknowledge. Two is L's label. Three is actually validate the experience. So like, you know, putting ourselves in their shoes, so validating the experience. Four is soothe. So what soothes them, you know, which is the sensory corner, taking a drink, taking a walk, whatever. Then five, I always say the step five, the P is very, very optional, especially for teenagers, because five is problem solving. For children, I think it's almost a given that we probably have to help them solve their problems or guide them through solving the problems. But teenagers don't always want that. Sometimes the teenagers want you to leave them alone. And even for older children, sometimes, especially for the really bright ones, sometimes they want to figure out the problem on their own. Sometimes that's a wrong assumption to make. Then it sort of shuts down the communication barrier in that sense that we have. Because then the kid just goes, oh, you're not listening to me. Because I mean, nowadays, they do start the teenager-ish behavior a little bit younger. I don't know if you all know.
Hi, welcome to Partners in Upbringing. I'm Kalyani.
I'm Himani.
And we are parents just like you.
Always on a lookout. So come join us in our endeavor as we connect with parenting experts and fellow inspiring parents to know the best practices for raising happy and confident children.
Visit partnersinupbringing.com for podcasts, videos, blogs, and to connect with experts. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Partners in Upbringing.
You can listen to us on your favorite podcasting app, Partners in Upbringing, your trusted partner in your parenting journey.
Hello and welcome to the 49th episode of Partners in Upbringing. Today we are going to talk about one of the most crucial aspects of child development. One, which if nurtured in the right manner, will give a rock-solid foundation to our children and is even believed to be a better predictor of their success and happiness in life. Isn't that what we want for our children? Now, taking this thought ahead, let's go back a few years where IQ was the only parameter which defined a promising career and therefore success. EQ was not even really heard about. But today, the tables have turned. And all the traits that were taken for granted, like compassion, empathy, social skills, etc., have become the defining factors of anyone's success. And therefore, EQ as a topic is trending for the longest time. And now, people have realized that it's best to sow this seed right in your childhood for their children.
Let me share a very interesting perspective which I read. Psychologist Daniel Goleman estimates that at best, IQ makes up only 20% of the factors that determine life success, while other forces such as EQ, wealth, temperament, family education levels, and pure luck make up the balance 80%. That means cognitive skills, verbal comprehension, memory, reasoning, and processing speed will help academically, but they will only get a person so far in life. To really go the distance, those IQ traits should be rounded out with the EQ traits, like motivation, perseverance, impulse control, coping mechanisms, and the ability to delay gratification.
So today, to understand what factors impact the EQ of our children and what practices do we need to inculcate to develop their emotional intelligence, we are joined by an expert from Promises Healthcare, a Singapore-based mental health center, which offers a wide range of psychiatric, psychological, and physical well-being services for children, adolescents, youth, young adults, and adults. We have shared a link to their website in our show notes, so do have a look. They have a highly effective, diverse, and multidisciplinary approach to mental health.
And from the Promises team today, we have with us Ms. Mok Sook Fern. Sook Fern holds a Master's in Clinical Psychology from Curtin University and a Bachelor of Psychology Honours from Murdoch University. She provides psychotherapy and assessment services to children and adolescents. She has experience in helping clients with a range of emotional and behavioral difficulties, including anxiety, depression, self-harm, suicidality, school-related stresses, and anorexia nervosa. Hello, Sukhfern. Welcome to Partners in Upbringing. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Most of us have heard and even used the term emotional quotient or emotional intelligence, but we are not sure if we are using it in the right way. Some parents I've heard say that my kid is very sensitive, so he has a high emotional intelligence. But some say that my child can really manage his emotions well and his EQ is very high. So can you help us understand exactly what is emotional intelligence?
I think the better indicator of high emotional intelligence is the ability to be able to manage their emotions and be able to identify their emotions appropriately. So I would say, I guess the second parent who says that, you know, my child's able to manage emotions well, that would be, I guess, an indicator of high emotional intelligence. Sensitive children, I find, tend to feel emotions stronger, perhaps compared to their peers. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they may not necessarily have the ability to manage them properly. But I think for children who are sensitive in that sense, it's actually even more important to teach them how to manage their emotions well. Because for sensitive children, emotions can actually overwhelm them a lot easier compared to their peers. Yeah, so if managed well, then you would have a child who's really empathic. You know, they will be able to sympathize with other children. They'll be able to manage their own emotions without allowing the emotions to overwhelm them. So you'll have a child who is sensitive but also has very high emotional intelligence.
We most commonly use that I'm happy today, I'm sad today, I'm angry today. But when you were speaking of emotional literacy, it just struck my mind that we don't talk a lot about the other emotions, much to the child. So would you like to suggest some tools or some games or some ways in which parents can increase the emotional literacy of their children? The first thing which comes to my mind is the series of books of Mr. Men. Wherein you have Mr. Funny and Mr. Sad and Miss Chatterbox and Little Miss Silly. I've really enjoyed reading those books. But apart from that, what can be done to help them know exactly which emotion feels, how does it feel?
All right. So I guess when it comes to teaching feelings, definitely we can start from a young age, we can start with things like feeling charts. So it's usually just feeling faces of maybe about 10 to 12 emotions. You can find them on Google really easily. Then you can print them out either in A4 or make them like really big, you know, stick them on the wall. Then, you know, every day you can check in with the child. You know, which one have you felt today? You know, which one did you feel in school? Which one did you feel when your brother took your toy? You know, that sort of thing. Then we can play games with them like emotional charades. So emotional charade would be the basic one would be just the faces, right? Like say angry, you know, how does my face look like when you're angry? Then you know the child will show, then after that, who's mom's turn or daddy's turn, then the brother's turn or sister's turn. Then after that, when they're a little bit older, we can also teach them, okay, not just the face, right? Because our feelings are not only in our faces, we also feel feelings in our body that other people cannot see. So it's important to know what we feel inside the body and then teach them, you know, these are the body clues, as I call it. So like, say, if you are nervous, you have a fast heart rate, you know, you would breathe faster, your tummy feels funny, you know, maybe your feet get cold. And then, you know, as parents, we can reflect certain behaviors that we see that they may not necessarily link to nervousness, like, you know, you talk a lot or you pace around the house a lot more. So once they're able to understand this combination of body clues in that sense equals like nervousness, then they'll know that, oh, nervousness is my face, it's like that, then my body clues are like that. Then another feeling like fear, for example, is another combination. Then anger is another combination. Then when I feel sad is another combination. When I feel happy is something else entirely. So they would know that. But I think for young children, I have this book series of storybooks that I guess are appropriate to read to, I guess, toddler, maybe older toddlers and children. So it's by Trace Maroney. So I don't know if you've seen like these ones before. So this one goes through like when I'm feeling happy, there's lonely, scared, sad, jealous, angry, disappointed, nervous, loved, and kind. So it's a nice
so teaching through storybooks.
Yeah, teaching through storybooks is another way to go as what well. What's the name like? Trace Maroney. And then there's also tips at the back for they'll tell you kind of like what
you
can do to help them as well.
So tell me if I've understood this right. If the child is able to manage their emotions, is basically to understand and have that balance of not getting overwhelmed. If the opposite of this happens, then the child becomes self-centered. Is that right? Because then they cannot focus on what's happening to others because they're so soaked into what's happening inside them, or maybe they don't know about it. And that's why children who are able to empathize with others. Is that right?
Or I guess self-centered is there more to this? I guess would not be the term I would use in this case. You have a point there where if the child is overwhelmed by their own emotion and can't quite manage, you know, that sort of the wave, the strong wave that comes, they will not be able to empathize or be there for their friend if it's like a situation with a peer. They do need to learn how to, I guess, also respond appropriately emotion-wise, because sometimes there are times where some children will respond in an appropriate manner, either like too much or too little. So the response to that particular emotion needs to match the situation as well. So this is something that children also have to learn. But that being said, developmentally, children are typically not able to sort of see from someone else's point of view until they're probably starting ages, probably about 4 or so. So typically, kids younger than that, like toddlers, they are very self-centered in that sense because they don't have this ability to understand that, hey, other people see the world differently. Than
the brain is still getting developed.
Yeah.
So, Sukhvan, as a parent, right, where do we start? What can we do to ensure that our children have a higher emotional intelligence?
So I think it starts from when they're babies. It starts from when they're told how to start from when they're young. You know, teach them to label, then slowly teach them how to manage.
So Sukhvan, where do we start as a parent? We all want to raise emotionally intelligent children. So what all should be done?
So I think the main thing is to start young. As for a lot of things, from when they're babies, even as newborns, you know, they cry for various needs, right? So they cry when they're hungry, they cry when they're tired, they cry when they want to cuddle, they cry when they want you, they cry when they're tired. So, you know, even in those situations, you know, we can also actually start just telling them that, oh, you're tired, you know, let's put you to bed, or oh, you're dirty, let's, you know, get your diaper changed and something. So then they also start understanding that they have needs, or, you know, certain things has happened to their body. And then when they get a little bit older, they get a bit more aware of the surrounding, when actual, I guess, sort of feelings come into play, then it will be reflecting feelings back to them, like, you know, you're happy, you're sad, you're angry, you're frustrated, you're hurt.
If you are enjoying this conversation, please subscribe to us and give us a 5-star rating on the platform you're listening to. Thank you.
Yeah, all those sorts of things. So then, because typically children, toddlers will look to us to help them sort out their feelings, especially if it's the uncomfortable ones. So we need to be really good at, I guess, identifying what they're feeling so that we know the appropriate action to take to help them sort of resolve that particular problem. Because typically when they come to us, it's usually a problem and then it is linked to a particular emotion, like, you know, my toy broke, or my friend snatched my toy, or I want this but daddy says no, you know, that sort of thing. I fell down, or I want to continue playing, but then now you tell me I have to go and shower, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, it's labeling that. Then after, like, say, for example, if it's like a transition, like, say, you know, we you know, because we have schedules that we want them to follow, right? So then, for example, if they're still playing and then we need them to shower now because they have to go to bed already, then, you know, if they're upset, then we can go, you know, I can see you still really want to play, you know, you're really upset that mommy is asking you to shower right now and you really don't want to. It doesn't feel fair that, you know, you have to keep following our schedule, you know, that sort of thing. Like, just for us to try to put ourselves in their shoes. And it needs a lot of repetition of that before, as they get maybe a bit older, when they are school going in that sense, before they will be able to do that to their peers as well. Of course, their vocabulary wouldn't be as rich compared to us, but then it does build a very good foundation for them to actually be able to empathize and sympathize with their peers, which I think is very, very important when it comes to things like social skills and all that. Yeah.
While we're teaching them how to label their emotions and make them understand what they are feeling right now, how can we, you know, help them to identify and manage? When we say manage, there's a whole lot of thing that goes behind managing emotions. For children, all the more, because it's new. They're finding words to label it. They're really trying to identify, is this really the emotion which is matching with the label which I'm talking about? And so what does it, you know, mean to manage emotion?
So I think managing emotions, you're right, it is a very broad kind of term, but I think in a brief sense, it is just that the child learns the ability not to allow the emotion to overwhelm them. So they take certain measures to ensure that they sort of calm down, you know, for lack of a better word, so that they can sort of continue doing whatever they were doing previously. Now, how we would teach that would be, I guess it has to be deliberate in some sense. Like, say, for example, everyday incidental teaching would be like, you know, in that moment itself, once a little bit calmer, you know, we can go, all right, you know, now we're a little bit calmer, you know, next time we can take deep breaths. Or in the moment itself, we can go, okay, let's take big calm breaths, big balloon breaths right now, you know, to try to calm down. And then once they're a little bit calmer, then okay, they can talk, whatever. Because in the moment, sometimes they can't tell you what's actually going on. But in a more deliberate sense, you can play games like, you know, okay, let's all, it's almost like a charade, like say, rather than just showing on the face, right? If the child has a little bit more vocabulary, we could also go, okay, how else in the body are we feeling this? Like say, nervousness, for example, right? So how can people tell that you're nervous? Okay, by your face. Okay, your face, the nervous face. Okay, then what else is happening in your body that we may not be able to see, that you will know next time that, oh, this is nervousness. So the child might be able to go, oh, okay, maybe something funny in my tummy, or I start sweating a lot, I get cold feet.
The heartbeat changes,
or I start breathing really quickly. And then, you know, parents can also chime in, yeah, you know, when you're nervous, I also notice that you talk a lot, you know. Or sometimes the parents go, yeah, you go really quiet, or you start pacing up and down the house when you are nervous. So then the child learns that, okay, I do that. So that's like nervousness. Then after that, you know, scared might be another one. Then, so there's two parts, right? It's the part that people can see and the part that people cannot see. And the part that people cannot see is very important to teach them as well, because they also need to learn how to sort that out. And there are also times where certain feelings have certain, I call them body clues, so which is the body sensations. Certain body clues that are similar to other feelings. So it's a combination of all of those that is one particular feeling, and then a different combination for a different feeling. So we need to really quite deliberately teach them that, for them to be able to identify. And then, so once they know that, okay, managing, I think if we're talking about managing feelings, a lot of it is the uncomfortable kind of feelings, right? The anger, the sadness, the confusion, that sort of thing. So some families, they have like a little calm down corner for the children where they can just go. And then the calm down corner has things like maybe a small little bean bag, nice fairy lighting, some soft toys or whatever the child
wants to put in their
activities. Favorite activities, just for them to just sort of take a bit of a breather there. Then sometimes like the very on the spot one would be like, you know, teaching them how to take deep breaths, or like anger, you know, stomp their feet out. More appropriate when they're a bit younger, not so much when they're older. But when they're younger, I mean, we definitely can do that, because I think it is a good way of helping them sort of get the energy out. They escalate a lot faster. Then when they're sad, when they're crying, sometimes it's just, you know, giving, offering them a hug. Sometimes they respond very well to that, you know, hugging them really tightly. A lot of it is for younger children, when it starts off, it's very sensorial in nature. You have to engage their senses. You know, sometimes people will tell us like, oh, don't cry, you know, they'll start talking to you. What helps is that the person actually talking to us, or, you know, going for a walk, or, you know, having a drink of water and things like that. Mm-hmm. And children are like, because children interact with their world with all of their senses. So it makes sense that if emotionally they're sort of, you know, destabilized by the environment, they have to engage their senses again so that they sort of reestablish that equilibrium that they have with the environment. So a lot of it is sensorial. So we'll be looking at things like puppets, you know, for older children, having a drink of water, talking, drawing, you know, drawing the feelings out, reading. Some children will dance, you know, because sometimes it's uncomfortable energy, right? So you want to get it out.
It's basically regulating, right? As against distracting, because that's what most of the parents do, especially with the younger ones. Yeah. It's easy to distract, you know, just get them out of this emotion and put them into another emotion. Tell me, correct me if I'm wrong. Is that the right way to do it, or focus on things that regulate their emotion? Because then I think we're just brushing that emotion under the carpet
and maybe not addressing it at all. So, wrong.
Yes, correct.
Sometimes, if we don't acknowledge it.
Yeah, so I agree with you that distraction is not the most appropriate thing to do. But I think people do it because it's easy. And it's very effective.
And if the child is crying, sometimes we feel it's not so important, though it is of the highest importance for the child.
Correct. So, I mean, like my son, when he makes these expressions to me when his Duplo falls down on the ground and the whole world's ended. But to me, it's like, I know it's not a big thing, but I know it's huge to him, right? So I cannot also dismiss it, because to him it's like, he can't build it up because it's a really complex structure, you know. He needed help from us to help him build it. But so that means to him, when it's broken, it's like, it's gone, you know. I don't have it anymore. So it's a big thing to him, but to us, it's like, not such a big thing. Yeah, so I think as adults, we need to remember not to trivialize their emotions, because what they are experiencing is very real, even though it doesn't seem very big to us. But yes, I think in terms of, there is a place for distraction, but I think it should come after we acknowledge and we label the emotion for them and we validate their experience, like what is actually going on. Right. Then we can go, okay, shall we go take a walk, or shall we, you know, do you want a hug, or do you want a biscuit, you know, do you want a snack, or, you know, do you want to go somewhere else? Do you want help to rebuild this? No, this is the distraction part. But before that, what has to happen will be the reflecting of emotions, you know, the validating of experiences. Like, oh, you know, it's really upsetting that your Duplo dropped. Because at the back of mom, you know that they don't have the ability to do so.
Yes.
So then from there, after all those has happened, then the distraction has a place. Yeah. But I think sometimes, I mean, even for me as a parent, sometimes I also forget to do that. Then I just go, okay, the distraction part. Then I find that it takes him a lot longer to calm down. So I mean it is a conscious thing for me to do as well, because I think for most of us it doesn't come naturally to us, because that was not how we were brought up also.
So as a thumb rule, should we say that step one should be acknowledge,
yes,
step two should be label it, what emotion it is,
yeah,
and then help them regulate it with, maybe, as you mentioned, a corner or whatever sensory based activity they want, and then step four, maybe to distract and let them move forward.
Yeah, so I saw this very nice structure in a manual for treatment of anorexia. I think the author probably may have taken it from somewhere else, but that's where I saw it. So I'm gonna credit that there. They call it the ALVSP structure. So this is for how to sort of help, this is teenagers, to manage and regulate themselves. But we can definitely do this for children as well. So A, like you said, Kalyani, it's actually really similar. A, step one is acknowledge. Two is L's label. Three is actually validate the experience. So, like, you know, putting ourselves in their shoes, so validating the experience. Four is soothe. So what soothes them, you know, which is the sensory corner, taking a drink, taking a walk, whatever. Then five, I always say the step five, the P is very, very optional, especially for teenagers, because five is problem solving. Yeah. For children, I think it's almost a given that we probably have to help them solve their problems or guide them through solving the problems. But teenagers don't always want that. Sometimes the teenagers want you to leave them alone. So that's why I say for teenagers, step five is very optional, and you have to check with the teenager whether they actually want your help or not, because sometimes they don't. And even for older children, sometimes, especially for the really bright ones, or for those who, you know, those who are quite emotionally intelligent, sometimes they want to figure out the problem on their own. So, you know, if we sort of just jump in and automatically assume that they want our help, sometimes that's a wrong assumption to make. Then it sort of shuts down the communication barrier in that sense that we have, because then the kid just goes, oh, you're not listening to me. Because I mean, nowadays they do start the teenager-ish behavior a little bit younger. I don't know if you all noticed.
Oh, it. Way younger.
They start at like 10, sometimes 9 you start seeing it. Yeah, sometimes 9 you start seeing it already. Assess. Yeah, so I find it's quite good.
Supan, when we had spoken earlier, you know, about this topic, you had also mentioned about unstructured play, right? Now, it's kind of difficult to derive a linkage between unstructured play and emotional intelligence. So can you help us with that?
Play is very linked to a child learning how to regulate themselves, which is an indicator of emotional intelligence. So it's like how adults, we have to engage in self-care for us to be able to sort of, you know, manage the demands of our schedules and our lives. It's the same with children. You know, we cannot pack their schedules so full that they don't actually have time to themselves to, you know, collect themselves or do whatever they want to do. Because, I mean, if they're school going or they go to childcare, you know, their day is pretty much regimented by the center or by their teacher. So they don't really have that much time to sort of do what they want to do. And when children have an unstructured time to themselves to just do what they would want to do, within limits, of course, of safety, it helps them sort of, you know, calm down in that sense, because sometimes throughout the day, they've built up stress. They've accumulated stress just from running around or moving from one activity to another, you know, having had dinner, then go and shower, you know, and everything. So they just need that time to sort of just check out for a little bit. So it's very important for them to actually have unstructured play, you know, outdoor play as well. Because
so when we say unstructured, do we say that we don't monitor the play? What is exactly unstructured play? If they're playing Lego, is that unstructured?
So we don't intervene in that sense. We just let them do, you know, within the limits of safety. We just let them do what they want to do. So we don't go, okay, you play with this, or okay, you play with this, you know, sort of thing, because they've had enough of that already. Yeah. So you can definitely play with them, right? But you follow their lead. Because then it also is quite powerful for them, because then they also learn that this feeling of competence that, you know, hey, you know, mommy and daddy respects this time, or they are happy, they are interested in, you know, what I'm doing. Because sometimes as adults, we want to show things to our children, like, you know, hey, look at this, learn this, you know, that sort of thing. But sometimes it doesn't go
always
the other way
in
around,
the
like,
teaching mode.
Yes, always in the teaching mode. So then when our children show us this, mommy, look at this, then sometimes we're like, you know, we're busy, we go, oh, you know. But then when we really, you know, take an interest in what they're doing, or like, oh, look at that little tower that you built, you know, or look at the car that you built. My kid the other day made these, they call it brain flicks, so they're little circle ones. And then he made just like a line, and he told me he was a lizard. Okay, I was a lizard. I go, wow, what a nice lizard you made. So, you know, when we, I mean, of course, for toddlers, I think we need to exaggerate it a little bit, but it does really help build their self-esteem, their competence. And children with good self-esteem, high emotional intelligence, you know, they are more well-adjusted, you know, they adapt to changes easier. They adjust to new environments easier. I guess they are more willing to try new things, because they know that, you know, even if I'm not so good at it, it's, you know, it's actually okay. I can just give it a go. You know, mommy and daddy will be there to help me and things like that. So actually, having like unstructured play, having, I guess, good boundaries and routines and things like that at home is very important, not only for emotional intelligence, but just the overall development of the child as well.
Actually, it's great because then unstructured play actually becomes a tool to regulate emotions. And it's like one addition to the list of what you have already told us.
Correct. Because this is like their child's, the child's time to just unwind, basically.
When we look at emotional intelligence holistically, apart from all these behavioral changes which we parents need to bring in or try to encourage our children, what else helps in development of emotional intelligence?
I mean, like I said, it is teaching, but I think that another component is that we need to show our children that we ourselves can actually manage our emotions well, because, you know, we are also part of the equation. And for I'm guessing for a lot of parents nowadays that managing emotions appropriately sometimes doesn't come naturally to us. So, I mean, either, you know, by how we were brought up or, you know, the environments we were in. So sometimes we need to really consciously check ourselves.
We are the biggest role models for them.
Make sure that, that we are regulating ourselves first, because if we can't regulate ourselves, there is no way that we can help our children regulate. Mm.
Sukhwan, would you like to talk about the role of routines?
Yeah, so I mean, routines help keep the child's day predictable. When a child generally is able to predict what comes next in the day, or, you know, at home, this what comes next, it helps lower their stress levels, because they know that nothing funny is gonna happen. As much as possible, when other things happen, like, say, for example, if you're going out before, then we're coming home, you know, we can always tell them that, hey, we're going out, then we're coming home, you know, for example. But generally, the day-to-day routine, bedtime routines, you know, ideally, it would be as solid as possible, and, you know, not change, generally around the same time, so that the child knows that, okay, by this time I have unstructured play, then I go and shower, then I read my book, then, you know, I can chit chat with mommy and daddy, then after that I'll go to bed and I'll sleep, then I'll turn off the light, then I'll see them tomorrow. So if every day it's like that, then the child feels calm at home, because they know what is going to happen next. They might fight it, you know, like, say they know that dinner time is going to come after playtime, for example. Of course, most kids are probably want to play and not eat, but at least they know that, okay, you know, eventually, no choice, I still have to go and eat, because actually I am very, very hungry. So it is very important for the routines to be generally in place. A bit of flexibility is okay, but generally the routines are sort of followed. It really does help to regulate them just on a basic level.
How does emotional intelligence, basically managing emotions, contribute to the success of the child in the future? Can you help us link the two and establish the relation?
Okay, so I think it's a basis in which we teach our child how to navigate the world in that sense, because humans are inherently very, very social beings. And high emotional intelligence, we know, you know, usually predicts better social skills, you know, better social adjustments. So these children will be able to adapt well in environments. They will be able to learn quickly in new environments. They will be able to make appropriate friends, so that they know, you know, if these ones are, like, you know, not so good in an influence, then I'm going to stay away from these children, or bullies, for example. They will know how to hang out, I guess, with the correct children. The well-behaved children. They will be able to regulate themselves enough that they can apply themselves to what they need to do, like their studies or their sports or whatever they want to do. So all of these things build what we call executive functioning skills. So executive functioning skills are skills of, like, the higher order kind of cognitive skills. So it is actually linked to IQ in that sense. So executive functioning skills will be looking at things like planning, you know, organization, delayed gratification, goal setting, and all these sort of things that we want our teenagers, you know, going to be adults, young adults, to have, right? But a lot of it starts when they're young. So having high emotional intelligence sort of helps the child to be able to better navigate, like, a school environment, a social environment, such that they are able to sort of better apply themselves to what they need to do in school to succeed.
Okay, so that's a lot of clarity, actually.
As parents nowadays, we are always complaining that children nowadays are very sensitive. Children nowadays don't have the motivation. Children nowadays give up very fast because maybe there is so much excess or whatever society is offering right now. So as an expert, do you feel that, yes, this is true, that nowadays the emotional intelligence is a bit lesser than what it was maybe when we grew up? Do you feel the same?
I wouldn't say it's less. I would say that parents are more aware now, but they don't. Some parents don't necessarily have the skill of how to teach. It is true that the society and the world nowadays has, I mean, our children have a lot more access to resources, as I call it, in the world. Sometimes they're not ready for that level of access to the resources. Children can get overstimulated if we give them too much. And I think this is a problem where it comes, when we're talking about sensitive children, their threshold is a little bit lower compared to the other peers. So we overload them, for example, then it's too much for them. Then they can't regulate themselves. Then you would see, you know, behavioral issues like they're lashing out or they're kicking their friends or they're just not paying attention in tuition class or enrichment class or something like that. So it is important to understand where the child's limits are and not sort of go past it. It's okay for us to push them a little bit because, you know, that's how children grow. But we cannot push them beyond a certain level that they're not ready for. So that's where the unstructured play bit comes in also, because, you know, it is their time to unwind because their day is already so
true,
busy.
True. They're jumping from school to classes to their CCAs.
Yeah, I know. I mean, there are some times where, you know, they have like lunch in a car or something. It's not even like sitting down at the table and, you know, having a nice meal, chit chat with mom and or with mom, you know, or even your helper, you know, or something like just that human connection is not, you know, you're being driven, you're eating in the car just to go to your CCA or a class or something like that.
Do you believe that screens or technology overload also can cause lower development of interpersonal skills or emotional intelligence?
Especially add to her point, you know, when kids are playing these video games where you are shooting people, you know, virtually, you are just getting them out of your way to reach your goal, right?
Yeah.
It's so easy there and it feels right there. In the same state of mind, you unknowingly try to apply in the real life also. So that's why this question.
So, I mean, okay, so screens, sensitive topic, okay? But then we could have like a whole episode on screens, I'm sure. But then I think when it comes to screen time, okay, in terms of games, there's a reason why there are ratings there. And I think sometimes, unfortunately, the ratings are not followed. So, you know, I've seen a lot of cases in my clinic where, you know, 9, 10-year-olds are playing games for like 16, 17, 18-year-olds. You know, their minds are their brains are not ready to handle that level of aggression. Their brains are not ready to handle that level of violence because their brains don't know how to process it. So unfortunately, if these children are exposed to that level of aggression and violence, for example, of these games, which, I mean, those games typically are rated at that level, they don't know any different, right? So they would think like, okay, this is how reality is. I'm going to start copying these behaviors. Then sometimes this is where they kind of get into trouble in school as well. But definitely screen time, there is a time and place for screens. I'm not saying there should not be any screen time at all because I don't think that is... our kids grow up in a digital world, so they have to learn how to navigate screens. They have to learn how to manage their screen time properly. Typically, we would recommend no screens maybe about 1.5-2 hours before bedtime, just so that the blue light doesn't sort of overstimulate them. This goes for every kind of screen, so we're looking at things like TV, phones, tablets, computers, all of that.
And I think just going back to your point where you said human interaction, human touch is also very essential. So
yes, so that is also important. So if they're spending too much time in front of the screen, then they lose the opportunity to connect with people or learn how to, you know, learn how to socialize with people because they are interacting with the screen. And the interaction on the screen is very sort of one-sided. because, like, you know, if I press a couple of buttons, then something else responds. But then, you know, the response is also going to be the same. But then in a social situation, you know, if I give the other person a social cue, then the person picks on it, they respond to it, then I may have to respond differently the next time because the cue might not be always the same. But they have to learn that.
Yes.
It can't be taught.
And if you find the other person boring, you still have to tolerate them for at least some time and not press a button and get a more interesting version.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't, right? You can't press the button and go, okay, say this.
Tolerance
say this.
Levels you will go up.
Yeah. I think all parents, it's very important for us to remember that, you know, this linkage between EQ and success of your child and the role it plays to ensure that you are securing their future and, you know, developing them into good human beings.
Yes.
Thank you so much for helping us understand this in detail, in depth, and also giving us the action points of what we can do right at the beginning to lay the foundation. And I think we also somewhere went into the teenage part, came back from there. So I think that was great. I really loved the way we maneuvered through this conversation and covered almost all age groups. So thank you once again, Supvarn. It was great talking to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a great conversation. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
With this, we come to the end of this episode. Our next episode is super special as we will be completing the Golden Jubilee, a 50 episode milestone. Last 2 years have been so enriching and wonderful for us as podcasters and as parents, as we have spoken to more than 50 parenting experts and fellow inspiring parents from across the world.
And on this occasion, we've put together all our learnings in a single power-packed episode. And we will be releasing it as our 50th podcast on Thursday, the 13th of April, 2023. So do look out for this special episode. And thank you so much for tuning into Partners in Upbringing and sharing it with your friends and family. Without your support, this journey would not have been possible for us. Thank you so much. See you next time. Goodbye, stay safe, and happy parenting.
Happy parenting. The content of this podcast is the copyright of the makers of this podcast, Partners in Upbringing. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at your own risk. This podcast should not be considered as professional advice unless stated. Please refer to https://www.partnersinupbringing.com for further details.